The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
One World Observatory.
Observatory, straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
438.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
She subconsciously mocks that lineage, but she's
so that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you caught the broadcast of the Emmys last week, you were probably not terribly surprised by this.
And the Emmy goes to Julie Louis-Dreyfus.
What?
Julia Louis-Dreyfus has won the award for Best Leading Actress in a Comedy 6 times, the most Emmys ever given for one role. And the show Veep is only 6 seasons old, so she's 6 for 6. She plays Selina Meyer, a terrible hack of a vice president who finds herself suddenly in charge of the United States of America. I spoke with Julia Louis-Dreyfus in March of last year as an even more unlikely election, a real one, was just beginning to take shape. So I was just in a meeting with one of our political correspondents. We were talking about how to cover this insane election.
Yeah.
And I said, by the way, I'm going to go interview in about a half an hour Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and she's amazing in Veep. And he got all excited. He said, this is the one thing I've ever seen in my life on television or in movies that it's exactly the way politics plays out behind closed doors. That people are amoral, crazily ambitious, and you did a lot of research. You talked to chiefs of staff and office holders and so on. And what were you hearing that began to inform what Veep would be?
I think it's what I heard and also what I didn't hear, you know, sort of reading between the lines, talking to these people. And then also, you know, at the end of the day, they're just like you and me. I mean, in other words, the parallels between politics and show business are there. And
craven, venal, money hungry,
yeah, ambitious, amoral. and nasty, and a lot of huge amounts of ego. And
were the people honest with you? Did they say
some people were and some people weren't? But
okay.
You can tell a
okay,
lot.
Okay,
so of time.
Who was honest with you?
Well, who was honest with me? I had one woman who's a scheduler for a senator.
Yeah,
and she said that she sleeps with her BlackBerry next to her head, and she said that proudly. And she said that she keeps when her boss travels, which he does frequently for around the globe, that she gets on his time zone. So, and she said nobody knows him better than I do, and it was. And she said that sort of with a kind of a maniacal look in her face.
Like a 50s office wife in one of those rom-coms.
Yes, except she's quite young. This woman was quite young.
So it had a nice creepy edge to it.
Well, I don't mean that she was like, it wasn't a sexual thing necessarily, but it had a funky vibe to it.
But did you get a sense when you were around politicians and people in politics that they believed in something?
With certain people I do, yeah.
Who?
With certain people I do. Well, I think Joe Biden believes in something very strongly.
And what's been your conversations with him about your shared office?
Well, let's see. I mean, he confirmed, it was interesting talking to him because I spoke also to Al Gore. And they both sort of said similar things about there is a kind of, it's the number two position. There's a reality there that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, that you're waiting for somebody's health to go, or you're in the wings.
Nobody. I don't think anybody who strives or desires or dreams about getting into politics dreams about being the vice president.
Do you get the sense that vice presidents wake up in the morning and it's in some corner of their souls they cannot stand the president for this reason? Because in the show, that's clearly the case.
Well, in the show, it's yes, and she can't bear him, and then, but I really think nothing is as it seems, and I think that's what this show is about. You know, whether she's president or vice president, nothing is ever quite attainable.
The show is going to resume in late April.
Yeah,
on HBO. Meanwhile, there's this crazy election going on. As we're sitting here, Donald Trump seems to be pulling ahead and becoming the Republican candidate. BuzzFeed did a very smart thing. They went on the collected interviews that Howard Stern has done with Donald Trump about women. How do you compete with reality?
Here's the thing. When this show started, it was political satire. And now it feels really like a somber documentary. I don't know what else to say. If you took language that these guys are saying, you put it into our script, we would get notes from HBO saying it's too broad.
Too much.
It's over the top.
Yeah, can't do that.
Right.
Yeah, no insulting Mexicans and no thinking about sleeping with Princess Diana.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that going to influence how the show goes?
Mm-mm, no. I mean, we've created this sort of alternate universe where obviously none of these...
I mean, your guys look like Thomas Jefferson by comparison.
Maybe I should run as Selina Meyer.
Well, and you're not going to tell us if you win or you're going to lose, but what's going to happen to the character of Selina? Does she change? Does she grow? Does she hug?
Come on. What the fuck are you talking about? Never.
What are her politics?
Her politics,
I don't even know what party she belongs to.
No. You don't know what party she belongs to. Her politics are all about her and staying alive. Her politics are me politics. And she will hold any position if it keeps her in office. Those are her politics.
You've described the differences between Veep, but sometimes there's a wonderful obsession about absolute nonsense. We have a clip here where... the staff, which would probably be talking about, I don't know, higher policy matters of domestic or foreign kind, talks extensively about pancake flipping.
Oh, yeah.
Ma'am, okay. This is the pancake brunch setup. General holding area here.
Yeah.
Juices and coffees, hot plates and griddles.
Okay, the minute you see bubbles, you flip.
No, you flip when you see holes. Bubbles is too soon.
Holes, not bubbles.
Okay, I flip at bubbles, but...
Fun fact, there are three kinds of syrup. Boysenberry, maple, and buttermilk.
Uh-huh.
Buttermilk is not a syrup.
Okay, ma'am, what if you said this?
Yeah.
Who's aching for some bacon?
No.
What's wrong?
Okay, I can't prep anymore, all right?
Really?
I might vomit on Mike.
Yeah.
Now, this is a scene that comes right off of C-SPAN in a way. You know these documentaries, The Road to the White House, and you see them set up some kind of thing for a candidate.
Of course, yeah, this happens all the time. Yeah, there's no reason to think that it doesn't happen. They do have these conversations. Going from one fucking event to another. Can you imagine how exhausting that must be? And trying to seem like you're so happy to be there.
Delighted to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, I'm so happy I'm not a real politician.
Are you?
Yeah.
You'd be brilliant.
No, I wouldn't.
No.
Mm-mm.
She's kind of not even brilliant, too. And she
no,
knows
she's terrible.
It. She knows it.
No, she thinks it's everybody else's fault.
Fair enough. So you began in a kind of improv background, in a theater background in college.
Yes.
And you were in a successful production. A producer walks backstage, and he or she is from Saturday Night Live.
He.
And you're off to the races.
Yes.
Am I wrong and think it's been a pretty charmed career?
No, you're not wrong. I mean, it hasn't all been, you know,
easy.
Chocolate and Roses.
Yeah.
But it has been a lot of fun. And even in retrospect, looking back when it wasn't fun, I guess it sort of was in a weird, bizarre way. But
is it what you wanted? When you were doing theater in college, did you think, well, if I could have my absolute druthers, if this could all go well, I could be, and then you thought Meryl Streep, or you thought Gilda Radner, or what was in your mind in terms of ambition?
I wanted to get a job. That was my ambition.
Yeah.
I wanted to be taken seriously as an actress, and I wanted a gig. And so, yes, my dream has come true. And particularly, I would say now, I really like working in an ensemble, which I very much feel that Veep is.
And you were in an ensemble, Saturday Night Live, but it turned out the ensemble was not a happy family.
At all.
And
right.
Why not? What, you went there, you thought this is the best of all possible worlds. You get there, and the one person you connect with is the most miserable son of a bitch on earth, which is Larry David, who's incredibly unhappy, getting none of his sketches on the air.
Correct.
And you're, what's happening with you?
Well, I cried a lot. I was very young, for starters. I was 21.
Were you misused, or were you not ready, or what was
all
what
of
was
the
happening?
Above? Yeah. Yeah. I will absolutely take responsibility for a lot of it because I was very naive. I came in thinking it was an ensemble. We'd all work together to find stuff. You know, I didn't know. I was a college student. I had no idea. I didn't come in with a bag of tricks. Now, the other thing I should mention is that a lot of people were doing drugs, big time drugs. I was, again, so naive. I just thought, you know, oh, that's so weird. That guy's script is, that sketch is like 17 pages long, and at the table read, he's howling, laughing.
I wonder why.
He seems so energetic.
Yeah. And he's sniffling. What's that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was kind of funky time.
And when you say it was completely male, the ethos was male, or just everybody at the writer's table is a guy?
All of it. All of it.
And it's not like this is 1947, and I don't mean to sound naive, but didn't anybody say this is missing half of human experience? And
no, people don't. No, that's not how. Maybe that's how people talk here at The New Yorker.
Yeah.
But not there. No.
Describe this. In other words, describe the world of Hollywood, why there aren't more women in places of authority, directors, producers, and more to the point, studio heads. Same thing goes with race. And yet, this is liberal Hollywood, supposedly.
Isn't this the reality almost in any business? Big business, big money-making business? And I'd love for you to tell me, well, no, it's not the case in, but what is it not the case in?
Yeah. And so what's happening? Is anything happening in Hollywood? Is there a louder, more intelligent, more forceful discussion and a proactive effort to right these wrongs that you sense, or is it just a lot of chatter?
I think it's a lot of chatter, and
really?
I don't mean to sound discouraging. I mean, I'm pushing back all the time as much as I possibly can. You know, it's been interesting because it's taken. I'm producing on Veep, but getting a credit as a producer in my lifetime has been. Sometimes I've gotten a lot of pushback on it in a way that I wonder if would be the case if I was a man.
And how does the pushback take shape? How does it?
It's a negotiation that is hard. That is hard. That seems like certain parties aren't going to move on. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that HBO has been difficult in any way to deal with. That is not the case. But there have been other instances in my life in which I've produced and there's been a pushback. Anyway, I got my way. So that's good.
Julie, thank you.
Are we done?
We're done.
Thank you very much.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it.
It was fun.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus. She's won 6 Emmys for her role as President Selina Meyer on Veep.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. obvious, but with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Nicholas Britell is in his mid-30s, and he composed his first film score 15 years ago. He took a little career detour. He spent years in finance as a currency trader. But he kept writing music all the while, and eventually he broke into the mainstream with The Big Short, a movie about the financial crisis. And last year, his score for Barry Jenkins' Moonlight was nominated for an Oscar. Britell's latest project is Battle of the Sexes. It's about the 1973 tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, starring Emma Stone and Steve Carell, and it's just come out.
It's Bobby Riggs.
Bobby? How'd you get my number?
Called every hotel in San Diego. Listen, I had a great idea.
Okay. Well, it's after midnight, Bobby, so can we talk another time?
You and me, Billie Jean. 3 sets, 5 sets, your choice.
Are you drunk, Bobby?
No, of course not. How about this? Man versus woman. Male chauvinist pig versus hairy-legged feminist. No offense. You're still a feminist, right?
I'm not interested, Bobby. Good night.
Don't hang up.
And by the way, I shaved my legs.
The New Yorker's Henry Finder spoke with Nicholas Britell.
In the old days, it seems to me, most composers, when they weren't writing sacred music, were writing in the service of story. You think of Henry Purcell in the 17th century. He becomes the greatest English composer writing incidental music, theater music, ballet music, opera. But it's all serving story. And Beethoven was obsessed with his Egmont music, which is what? Soundtrack to a play. So to me, movie music is actually the great tradition. It's music's highway. It's not the byway.
I think that idea of musical storytelling is really interesting because for me, one of the things that I love about movies is they provide this amazing form to inspire music. It's totally possible to write music on its own, sort of abstract, you know, music. But I've just always found that the interaction of all those elements moves me. Sometimes I feel music more strongly actually in that theater context than I do outside of it.
Yeah, I want to get to that idea of the interaction of elements. But what I'm kind of jazzed about right now is Battle of the Sexes, this movie about Billie Jean King and her match against Bobby Riggs, which you scored. And this is, yes, a very music-forward film. I mean, this movie is like a piano concerto in the key of tennis. That Billie Jean King cue.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it builds,
yes,
and develops. This is what it got me thinking about. One thing was the amazing power of the piano and orchestra combination. It made me think about that 1945 Noel Coward film, Brief Encounter.
Yes, yes.
David Lean directed, which uses the Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto.
Absolutely.
And, of course, Vangelis's Chariots. And what is it that makes this combination so powerful?
That's a great question. I mean, I think for me, I remember when I first heard the Rachmaninoff's second concerto, you mentioned from that film, I remember I first saw it, there was a Van Cliburn piano competition that they aired on PBS, I think in 1990, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that summer, I had a VHS of it, and I watched it. I must have watched it, you know, twice a day for the entire summer. And that year, it culminated with a performance by the pianist Alexei Soltanov performing the Rock II.
Mm-hmm.
My whole world that summer was the Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto.
That's perfect.
So for me, I've always been drawn to piano orchestra combination, and I think the concerto as a form itself is something very fascinating because it's dramatic in and of itself. It's almost like a dance that happens between the more forward virtuoso instrument and the orchestra. And I think in a lot of ways, the best concertos are the ones where that interplay is most integrated. So I'm definitely drawn to that sound, but I always try to, at the beginning of a film project, figure out what is the sound of this film. And for Battle of the Sexes, the sound of the piano was something that Jonathan Dayton, Valerie Faris, and I, the directors and I, we were drawn to it. Over the course of the film, the orchestration evolves until by the time you reach the match, it's a full symphony orchestra. And the themes that you've heard in a more intimate setting earlier in the film are now writ large on a full orchestra.
Yeah, I was so struck by that. The piano concerto as a form can almost be like a tennis match at times. And it felt like you had to up the stakes even further. At a certain point into that match, you switch from piano to organ. So it's like we're in a cathedral now and we're enlisting the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost to go where we need to go.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite moments in the film, actually, is in that match where you hear that organ. We wove that in earlier in the film. It's very in the background. It's it's actually more of like an accompanying texture to some of the very early scenes.
Yeah.
And it has that sort of featured moment central in the match. And there's something about that too, where thinking about sort of like the scope of an orchestration and how you make something seem very big. Mm. And one thing I've found over time is that sometimes more is actually less. Adding instruments to a point makes things very large, but there's a real power I find to pulling everything out. And, you know, sometimes just a solo piano or one note on a violin on its own can feel massive.
So let's talk about another film you worked on. You were nominated for, won several awards for your score for Moonlight, you know, the Barry Jenkins film about the three stages in the life of this African-American boy growing up gay in Liberty City, Miami, and music is so central to that film. What kind of brief did you get from Barry Jenkins?
That was an amazing experience to work with Barry on Moonlight. So from our first conversations, we were already kind of brainstorming ideas of what might happen. But I had read the screenplay before the film was shot, and musically, the early conversations that, you know, we had had, there was an idea, I think, in Barry's mind that he really wanted real instruments. He wanted this to be a score that had a human feeling. From pretty much the very beginning, Barry had told me about his love of chopped and screwed music, which is a style of Southern hip hop where you take tracks and you slow them down. And when you slow the track down, the pitch goes way down. So there's this totally deepened and enriched musical texture that the audio takes on. You know, we were just like, what if we did that with a classical score? Like, what if I recorded my own music and then I took those recordings and applied that chop and screw technique to them? And that's one of those ideas, I think, early on where it sounds interesting, but also you never know. It could work, it might not work. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the really exciting things there, one of those discoveries, was that when we put those ideas up against the picture, they totally worked. It felt like a musical evolution that was so interlinked with the evolution of Chiron. And those are those moments that I think you really, you know, artistically, you sort of live for those moments where something just feels so right and so connected in a way.
To me, an astonishing shift is when you really start to mine these Baroque textures. There's another cue from Moonlight. I'm thinking of the middle of the world. And the violin is doing these virtuosic arpeggios, and I think we're in D minor. And so you think of Bach's D minor, Chaconne, or even that passage in Sibelius's D minor violin concerto toward the end of the first movement with those rapid broken chords. And it's like we're not in Liberty City anymore. And I wonder, how did you get there?
That was a really important scene in the film. And that was one place where my initial thought was actually pretty different from where we wound up. My initial thought, I was seeing the swimming sequence where Juan is teaching Little to swim. And I had this idea of what if this was a moment of uplift? This was a moment of potentially a sort of happy memory of childhood. And Barry said to me, you know, this is a baptism. This is the beginning of the rest of his life. So there's something about the violin cadenzas, you know, talking about concertos again, but there's something about a violin soaring in that way that really moves me. And I remember I was with Barry in my studio in New York, and I said, what if we did something like this? And I started playing these arpeggios using a violin sample just to show kind of what it might sound like. And immediately Barry was just like, keep going with that, keep going. And right there, I actually wrote this with him in the room there. We, you know, it just happened totally organically like that together.
Yeah, I was listening to the soundtracks of a lot of the films you've scored, and often there's a kind of a spare neoclassical feel that comes back. But when you scored The Big Short, Adam McKay's movie about the 2007 financial crisis, there are a lot of elements that are just crazy, these sort of playful, upbeat melodies, a mouse click symphony, and some big, funky stings like the cue for when they go to Vegas. Actually, let's hear a bit of that. Seems like you got to have a lot of fun with Big Short. I mean, what were some of the challenges of scoring that film?
The Big Short was so much fun to work on. To see what this movie, this sort of incredible wild ride, through the financial crisis. What was the sound for that movie? And in The Big Short, there's actually a huge range of styles. There's no one sound to that.
Right
around when Adam was shooting the film, he had said to me that something he was wondering was, what is the sound of, like, dark mathematics? That was his idea. What would that sound like musically? And so I experimented with taking a piano and layering it with, like, six other pianos and running it through vinyl and then overlaying it with a hip-hop bass. So that started to be some of this feeling of the over-sophistication of the financial products.
Something you've said a couple times is the idea of not knowing what the answer is, a sense of a plenitude of possibilities. In general, it's like some film composers are known for a very particular type of composition, the John Williams, the sweeping orchestral thing in so many Spielberg movies, Michael Nyman's minimalist scorings, Philip Glass, I say, you know, he's as recognizable as Vivaldi. You're like a chameleon. I mean, you're not a one-trick pony, you're a 127-trick pony. Is that a gift or a burden?
I think when I was growing up, I always wondered, you know, what is my sound? Like, what do I sound like? And I think it's only in hindsight, in a way, that I see things in myself that I'm drawn to. Mm-hmm. Part of that, too, is just the world we live in is so complex. And with technology, there's really an infinitude of possibilities. Whereas historically, classical era, there were styles of the time. You know, there were much more set bounds to certain ways of writing music. I think today for composers, there's no form. There are no rules. So that does present its own challenges because, you know, what do you do? So I think for me, film gives you a set of constraints. Mm-hmm. You know, each film is its own set of constraints where we say, okay, you know what? We're going to be exploring the financial crisis of 2008. What does that sound like? I think, you know, Stravinsky wrote about that in his Poetics of Music, where he talked about how restraints can be so liberating, actually. And I fully second that feeling.
Film composer Nicholas Britell speaking with The New Yorker's Henry Finder. Britell wrote the score for Battle of the Sexes, which is just out. I'm David Remnick, and you've been listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thank you for joining us. Next week, I'll talk with David Simon about his terrific new show, The Deuce, and his remarkable run of gritty TV dramas drawn from real life. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrato. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythali Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Sarah Sandbeck and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.